talk of Reconstruction, a threat to their control of the state government, could be expected to oppose the commission's work. Its creation, therefore, would have the dual effect of splitting the Republican Party and lining up with Smith those Republicans who exemplified progressivism and reform to independent voters. The support of such Republicans would help negate Smith's greatest handicap, the Tammany label he bore. In addition, she reminded the leaders, the federal crowd were heavy campaign contributors. Before the motherly little woman had finished speaking, the roomful of politicians had realized that they were listening to a master politician. Al Smith had bought her suggestion on the spot. Reorganization of the state government was not a new idea. It had been a basic reform tenet for years, and in 1915, a Bureau of Municipal Research study commissioned by a state constitutional convention had found no fewer than 169 separate state departments, bureaus, boards, committees, and commissions, many with overlapping functions. Taxes, for example, being collected by 7 different agencies, public works being carried out by 10. Some agency heads were responsible to the governor, some to the legislature, and some to officials who were themselves elected by the people and were hence not responsible to either governor or legislature. Some agency heads appointed by the governor were removable only by the legislature, and there seemed to be almost as many different procedures of removal as there were men who could be removed. His term was only 2 years, and the terms of some gubernatorial appointees were longer, so that each incoming governor was forced to entrust the carrying out of some of his policies to men appointed by previous governors who might be politically opposed to him. Such nominal members of the executive department as the state engineer, treasurer, and secretary of state were not appointed but elected, and therefore, even if they were of the governor's party, did not owe their primary allegiance to the governor but to the voters, and could, if they wished, ignore his wishes with impunity. Most important, the study found that the governor possessed little real authority. Not he, but the chairman of the various committees of the reactionary and corrupt legislature controlled the state's purse. The document that was called a state budget was actually a collection of appropriations drawn up by these chairmen. No legislator, or any other state official, reviewed the collection, balanced one appropriation against another, cut them down to agreed-upon necessities, or measured them against estimated revenue. Even after the document was formally printed, individual legislators continued to introduce their own private bills, generally for pork barrel public works projects which required public expenditures, and these, when passed, did not even appear in the budget. No one bothered to add them up, so that when the legislature adjourned, no one could be sure how much money it had appropriated. The governor technically had the power to veto appropriations, but since state law forbade him to veto part of an appropriation item, legislators simply made sure that each debatable expenditure was lumped with one too essential to be vetoed. The Bureau had become convinced that it was this lodging of administrative power in legislature rather than governor that, more than any other single fact, explained the utter failure of 20 years of effort by a succession of liberal governors such as Roosevelt and Hughes to increase the involvement of the state with the new needs of its people. Because the governor stood at the head of the state and represented all of its people rather than just one assembly or senate district, the governor must be held responsible if the state failed to move as the voters wanted it to move. But going hand in hand with responsibility, the Bureau said, must be power. If a man was to be held responsible for moving government, he must be given power to move it. Executive power commensurate with executive responsibility, in the Bureau's slogan. To get power into the hands of the executive, the Bureau recommended a centralization of government functions. The 169 agencies should be combined into 12 departments headed by men appointed by and removable by the governor, whose term should be lengthened to 4 years. An executive budget system should be instituted. Under it, department heads would submit financial requests to the governor, who would weigh the requests against the resources and needs of the state and propose an overall budget. Only then would the budget be submitted to the legislature, which would review it in a series of hearings that would ensure that the public could understand it, and then would have the power to reduce it by eliminating items. The governor would therefore be proposing the way the state was to be run. The legislature would be reviewing the proposal, and if the differences between legislature and governor proved irreconcilable, the public would settle them at the next election. Furthermore, after policy had been established, it was to be administered by the governor instead of by the legislature's many committee chairmen. The Bureau's 1915 report, Government of the State of New York, was 768 pages long. With reform leaders taking the floor to argue for its principles, many of its key points were adopted by the Constitutional Convention. But Tammany and the upstate bosses outwitted the reformers by persuading them to combine all the proposed constitutional amendments in a single package, and distaste for one or two unimportant but unpopular amendments, combined with the quiet mobilization of Tammany and upstate machines, resulted in the defeat of the package in a November 1915 referendum. Bob Moses, who, as a Bureau staffer, had worked on its 1915 report, and who now, in his new job, recruited other staffers who had worked on that report, expected at first that the report of the Reconstruction Commission would be practically a duplication. But there was a bigger difference between working for the Bureau and working for Bell Moskowitz than sumptuousness of office arrangements. The Bureau made recommendations. Mrs. Moskowitz made laws. The Bureau got enthusiastic and excited. Mrs. Moskowitz got things done. And no sooner had her chief of staff begun work, 2 weeks before his 30th birthday, than she began to teach him how things got done. The lessons started almost immediately. When Moses submitted a preliminary outline of suggested commission goals, he included a phrase straight out of the reform textbooks and his Municipal Civil Service Commission days: elimination of unnecessary personnel. Mrs. Moskowitz struck the phrase out. Personnel, she said, were voters. You didn't antagonize voters. When Moses, copying a 1915 Bureau recommendation, suggested that the unwieldy 10-member council which ran the Department of Agriculture be scrapped in favor of a single professional commissioner, she pointed out that the council memberships were distributed by the legislature and were among the choicest patronage posts it possessed. The governor, she said, would need the support of the legislature if his program were to be approved. The council, she said, would remain. The lessons were given in daily morning conferences. Moses would arrive brimming over with ideas and impatient for their approval. But the reception they received from Mrs. Moskowitz was somewhat different from the one his ideas had been accorded by Mr. Moskowitz. As Moses excitedly paced around her office, she would sit calmly, attentive but noncommittal. When he finished, she usually would not say anything for several minutes. Often she would praise the ideas and break into a smile, full of real pleasure, at Moses' inventiveness. But equally often, Moses' ideas would be thrown out. There was a real divergence of opinion there, staffers recall. Moses was very theoretical, always wanting to do exactly what was right, trying to make things perfect, unwilling to compromise. She was more practical. She wanted to do the same things as Moses, but she wanted to concentrate on what was possible and not jeopardize the attaining of those things by stirring up trouble in other areas. And her decisions were always final. While Moses paced and argued, trying to change her mind, Mrs. Moskowitz would sit quietly and, when Moses had finished, would quietly repeat her earlier decision. There was never any question, recalls another staffer, that she was the boss. Often, Moses would come bursting out of Mrs. Moskowitz's office, cursing under his breath. Striding around the large room in which 30 staffers had desks, he would let the breath out. He used to call Mrs. Moskowitz all kinds of names, which weren't gentlemanly at all, one of the men who sat in that room recalls. I remember him saying, over and over, "Do you know what that old she-son-of-a-bitch told me this morning?" Once, lunging across the room in a rage so blind that he thudded into a desk, he paused for a moment, leaned down to the startled man sitting at it, and muttered grimly, "I could have kicked that woman in the shins." But, in spite of the cursing, there was a difference in Bob Moses. The man who had not hesitated to criticize to their faces his superiors at the Bureau of Municipal Research was careful that his cursing of Mrs. Moskowitz was done out of her earshot. He certainly didn't talk to her the way he talked about her, a staffer recalls. While he might dispute a decision heatedly, he stopped arguing once she made clear that the decision was final. Some of the staffers believed this change of attitude was due to a newfound prudence in a man aware that the opportunity he had been given with the commission might be his last chance to make good in his chosen career. One says, "If he had talked to Mrs. Moskowitz the way he talked to Cleveland or Allen, or to Mr. Moskowitz, he would have been thrown out, and if he had been thrown out of that job, that would have been the end of Bob Moses, and he knew it." Such an explanation, however, failed to take into account the full extent of the difference. For one thing, Moses was not only obeying Mrs. Moskowitz, but also obviously studying the lessons that she was teaching, and studying them hard. His conversation began to include the phrases of practical politics, as well as those of scientific management textbooks. His analysis of a state job began to take into consideration not only whether the position was necessary for the betterment of mankind, but also who had appointed the man who now held the position. He learned to weigh the governmental gains that might be achieved by the position's elimination and by the use for worthier purposes of the salary allocated to it against the political losses the elimination might entail, how much it would antagonize the appointer, and how great an obstacle such antagonism might be to Smith's overall program. The difference went deeper. It was not just that he obeyed Mrs. Moskowitz, and it was not just that he learned her way of thinking. Rather, it was that, after a while, he seemed almost eager to learn. He had always scorned the considerations of practical politics. Practical politicians had crushed and destroyed his dreams, and had come near to crushing and destroying him. They had done it with an ease that added humiliation to defeat. And now, given a chance to learn their methods, Bob Moses seemed almost enthusiastic about embracing them. He was an apt pupil. In his first conferences with Mrs. Moskowitz, they had discussed how the commission would go about obtaining from the Republican-dominated state agencies the information on salary and internal organization and promotion policy, for example, needed to evaluate the agency's work. Moses' initial reaction was straightforward. "Why couldn't commission staffers simply demand the information?" he asked. "Smith was governor, wasn't he? If an agency proved recalcitrant, Smith could simply order the agency head to cooperate." Mrs. Moskowitz made clear that the commission wouldn't proceed along any such lines. "In the first place," she said, "many of the agencies regarded themselves as independent of the governor. An order he gave them might be disobeyed. Even if it was obeyed, it could cause hard feelings, and the governor didn't want hard feelings. He wanted reform. He had only 2 years to make a start on it, and he was going to have plenty of trouble no matter how he went about it. He didn't want any more than was absolutely necessary. The commission must be very careful not to stir up any that could possibly be avoided." And not only did Moses, once so impatient and impolitic, become a model of discretion on his trips to Albany, talking only to men to whom Smith's aides could introduce him as a friend, to his staffers he repeated over and over, in urgent handwritten notes, "Be careful. Remember that we must not embarrass the governor." And the commission was able to avoid any angry confrontations with agency heads. The eyes that had picked Bob Moses out of the herd of young reformers were watching his progress. It was as spectacular as it had been at Oxford, where he had learned part of the political science. There, he had graduated with honors. Belle Moskowitz, who taught him another aspect of the science, did not confer degrees, but she awarded him her own type of honor. By the spring of 1919, less than 6 months after she had taken over Moses' tutelage, she was leaving the supervision of the State Reconstruction Commission almost entirely in his hands. The commission's work meshed with his personal convictions. Reorganizing government to make it more responsive to social needs was an aim that he had enunciated for himself in his Oxford thesis, and all his work in government thereafter had only strengthened his belief in the urgency of the need for such reorganization. More specifically, the reorganization on which the Reconstruction Commission was embarked was almost certainly going to be designed to increase the powers of the state's chief executive, and power for the executive was another theme that, at least in implication, ran through the thesis. The commission's work, moreover, was of a scope and an aim consonant with the sweeping, soaring, almost visionary quality of his idealism. For years he had laughed bitterly with other young reformers at the open chicanery of the Black Horse Cavalry, at the inefficiency of the system which sent tax collectors from 7 different state agencies to the same factory, at the utter hopelessness of the administrative machinery of New York State. Now, at last, here was a chance to replace that machinery, not just to oil it, but to take it apart and haul it away, and then replace it with a new one. Here was a chance to change a state, the most populous and influential in the nation. If Moses was hopeful of success this time, his hopefulness was not the naive overconfidence of his Civil Service Commission days. The success or failure of the Reconstruction Commission's efforts, he understood, was not in the hands of the commission, but depended on someone else. But he had real hope that this time the someone else might come through. Moses had been quite prepared to be disappointed by the governor he had called a typical Tammany politician. But Al Smith's speech to the prominent liberal Democrats, independents, and federal Republicans on the commission at its first meeting had certainly not been pro forma. Mangled cigar stubs stabbing out from his wet lips at the vested, watch-fobbed civic leaders before him, he had rasped, "Is this commission going to do something, or is it just going to offer a report? Are you going to have something definite that can be put into effect to benefit the state? Because if you are not, the sooner you report and go out of existence, the better." Nor had Smith's actions been pro forma when the Black Horse Cavalry refused his request for $75,000 to enable the commission to begin work. Here was a ready-made opportunity to reap political capital. As Mrs. Moskowitz had surmised, the GOP's federal wing raged against their party's legislators, along with most of the state's important newspapers. Without doing anything else, simply by letting the commission die and pointing out that the legislature had killed it, Smith would have scored a political coup. But Smith did something else. He asked the members of the commission to put up the $75,000 themselves, and when they did, he publicly promised that he would abide by and sponsor any recommendations it made when it completed its report. Often now, in the late afternoon, the governor would drop by the commission offices. He came primarily to obtain Mrs. Moskowitz's advice on some problem or other. "You could see," says one of the young commission staffers, "that Smith really trusted her. Over and over again I heard him say, 'Now, Mrs. M., you do so and so, or you look into such and such this week, and let me know how you feel about it.'" But on his way to the little office in the corner that had been reserved for him, and equipped with a big brass spittoon, the governor would stop and chat with the staffers, telling them the inside stories of political infighting going on in Albany, or kidding them about the pretty secretaries in the commission stenographic pool next door. When he finished talking to Mrs. Moskowitz, he would call them into his office, and, between well-aimed expectorations toward the spittoons, he would tell more stories. He would talk to them seriously, too. The frank, serious blue eyes that looked so out of place over the big-veined nose and the gold-filled teeth in the flushed face would stare straight into theirs. "I won't let you down," he would say. "You just get the facts and come up with the recommendations. I'll fight for them." Nobody could help liking Al Smith, one of the young men said. You had to like him, and you had to believe in him. Moses had worked hard before. He worked harder now. Some of his young staffers worked late. When they left, a light was almost always still shining through the frosted glass top half of the door to Moses' office. In the morning, the staffers would find on their desks long, detailed memos signed Robert Moses, Chief of Staff, outlining new assignments. Moses would criticize staffers' reports mercilessly. When he returned them, they would be adorned with large, angry double question marks. Sloppy phrasing would be slashed through. "Most essential question not discussed at all," Moses scribbled on one report. "What overhead organization do you propose? Do you believe in a commission or a single commissioner? If the latter, should a rules-making board be attached to him?" Staffers became accustomed to seeing Moses' handwriting filling the margins and spilling over their type and scrawled across the top of the first page, heavily underlined, "Revise all." Activity in the office revolved around the tall, wiry figure with the shock of black hair who worked in shirt sleeves rolled up to the elbow. He had appointed an assistant chief of staff, reformer Channing Schweitzer, too, but, impatient to work through a chain of command, when he had something to say to one of the staffers, he would come out of his office and say it himself. The tension disclosed in the heavy underlining of the written criticism on the reports would sometimes spill over in short but violent bursts of anger. When a key piece of paper was misfiled one day and a secretary had to report she could not locate it, he glared around the room and shouted, while the staffers discreetly studied the tops of their desks, "Where the hell did it go? Who's got it? Who's got it?" But if Bob Moses often shouted, he also often laughed, his teeth gleaming in a broad, infectious grin, and his laughter was never louder than when it was directed at one of his own mistakes, which he was usually the first to point out. He was friendly with the staffers, seeming to spend as much time during the day out in the big room in which their desks were located as in his office, hunting up luncheon companions with an easy and charming air that brought together large groups to accompany him to the German Rathskellers that lined the street back of the Hall of Records. Over lunch, he was a good listener, and, with his vivid accounts of his latest hassle with Mrs. Moskowitz and his vivid descriptions of the big shots on the commission to whom she had introduced him, a good talker. His personality, his knowledge, and his application inspired the young men under him. Many of them would go on to distinguished careers, but they would look back across the decades at the time they spent working for Moses as one of the high points of their lives. "Dedication has become sort of a phony word," staffer John Gauss said shortly before he died in 1969. "But that's what Moses had. People who are terrifically hard workers, you have got to respect anyway. But it was more than just how hard he worked. He was a vibrant and driving person. You just knew that if you wanted to work for him, you had to be on your toes. But on the other hand, that you would be treated with complete frankness. And you also knew that here was one person who was really thinking of the public interest above everything else. He talked to you hard and direct, but he made you feel that you were both on the same side, fighting for the same things. He made you want to work for him." Moses so fascinated Gauss that for more than two decades, while the young social worker was carving out a reputation as an author of books on public administration and as a professor of government at Harvard University, never seeing Moses during all that time, he collected every newspaper clipping about Moses that he saw, just so he could keep track of his career. After he retired in 1961, Gauss began collecting clippings on Moses again, filling them in cartons, which he kept in the attic of his Utica, New York home, and he kept filling those cartons until the day of his death. With the state's coffers closed to the commission by the legislature, money was constantly tight. Salaries were very low, but the young men said it didn't matter. In the spring of 1919, funds ran out entirely, and while Smith and Mrs. Moskowitz scrounged for private contributions, the young men received neither salary nor expenses for 6 weeks. Gauss and Morris Lambie, another young reformer, researching in Albany, were able to keep eating only by borrowing money from relatives. Once Gauss wrote Schweitzer, Since the wolf is approaching so near that I can hear his howls distinctly, I wonder if you can find one of those precious valentines lying around signed by Bell Moskowitz and assuring the bearer that the guarantee trust will do its damnedest to trade it in for good U.S. notes. If last month's salary is in the offing, why, I want to be there too. But when Gauss at last got hold of the pieces of information he needed to complete his report on the State Labor Department, money was forgotten. Mailing the report to Schweitzer with a special delivery stamp that cost him a substantial portion of the last change in his pocket, Gauss attached to the report a note, "Happy days. Let the people rule." Moses' jubilation matched Gauss's. None of the staffers found any reason to complain about their chief's enthusiasm over their successes. He had, they said, no side, no pomposity. He was, they said, very democratic. If they noticed a difference between the manner in which he treated them, men who were almost his equals, and the manner in which he treated men a step lower on the commission's totem pole, they didn't think it important. But the difference was there. The memos Moses addressed to lower echelon personnel were different in tone from even the most peremptory of those he sent to the staffers. In a memo addressed to a chart maker, for example, Moses laid out his assignment in the tone of an army drill sergeant, unsoftened by a single please or courteous adverb. "In connection with your assignment," he wrote, "you will do the following. You will prepare a chart showing the present departments. You will prepare a chart showing the proposed organization. You will keep in touch with Mr. Gauss, Mr. Buck, and myself. You will consult other members of the staff before putting the chart in ink." Moses' energy seemed inexhaustible. For the summer of 1919, he and Mary, along with two other couples with small children, the Henry Bruers and Frances Perkins and her husband Paul Wilson, rented bungalows near a beach in Douglaston, Queens. Moses never caught any train out from Manhattan but the latest available, which arrived in Douglaston about 8:30. Darkness would be falling, but Moses would always go for a swim. Plunging into the water, he would strike straight out Little Neck Bay, his arms windmilling rhythmically and powerfully, his head growing smaller and smaller in the distance. His friends would joke that he didn't seem likely to stop until he had crossed Long Island Sound and reached the shore of Westchester County, which on clear days was a low black line on the horizon. "He was a wonderful swimmer," Frances Perkins would recall. "I never saw a man who could swim so long, so easily, so far, with such confidence and security. We used to get nervous. He'd go way out where you couldn't see him. It being dark, we'd finally lose sight of him entirely. One night he must have been gone an hour and a half before he came back. The watchers thought he had drowned. Henry was discussing how we should break the news to Mary. What shall we tell her? We were all urging each other, 'Let's wait a little while. Don't call the police yet.' It wasn't until long after dark that the anxious viewers on the beach saw Moses returning." On Sundays, Moses didn't go into his office, but, as if unable to relax, would spend the days energetically teaching the three sets of children to swim, the evenings telling them stories he made up himself. "He was so good with children," Miss Perkins recalled. By the latter part of the summer, Moses was forced to work even harder. The commission's funds were running out, and the private contributions which had sustained its work were falling off. With his usual disregard for financial considerations, Moses had paid little attention to this state of affairs. If Gauss and Lambie were living off relatives, so was he. The major part of his income was still coming from his parents, but this didn't seem to bother him. And as for the work of the commission, he vaguely assumed that with all those wealthy men interested in its success, whatever was needed would somehow be raised. They had so much money they'd never miss a little of it, he would say. And anyway, fundraising was not his province, but that of the commission's executive committee. In July, however, Mrs. Moskowitz told him that he must begin laying off his staff at once. He had to let some of the young men go with only a week's notice. By Labor Day, the staff had been disbanded. Some sections of the report existed only in recommendation memos, others only in rough draft form. Only a few sections were actually completed. Lugging the commission's files to his already cramped apartment, Moses wrote the rest of the report alone. By October, it was finished. The report of the Reconstruction Commission to Governor Alfred E. Smith on retrenchment and reorganization in the state government contained little that was startlingly original. It didn't have to. In that government, little had changed. The Bureau of Municipal Research, in presenting its report to the 1915 Constitutional Convention, had concluded that the state's administrative organization has nothing in common experience or human reason to commend it. But in the intervening 4 years, the situation had only worsened. The Bureau's investigators had counted with shock 169 separate and independent state agencies. In 1919, Moses' investigators counted 187. The organization chart of the sovereign state of New York still looked like a web spun by a drunken spider, and the man elected to represent all the people of the state was still trapped in the web, unable to exercise power or leadership. What made the report written in the small apartment on 87th Street a remarkable document was its clarion tone and its clarity. Viewed as part of the long reform movement in New York State, which set much of the tone for progressivism in the United States, it was the summing up of this movement. The essence of the spirit of reform was captured in its 419 pages. So completely did the words they bore synthesize both its philosophy and its passion. The prose with which Moses prefaced the report had in particular the ring of the battle trumpet. The 5,200-word opening declaration of underlying principles, written almost entirely by Moses and left untouched by Bell Moskowitz, contained hard, lucid, driving reasoning that reduced complexities to fundamentals. Dealing with a point that reformers generally tried to avoid because of their fear that it was a weak spot in their argument, Moses plunged instead to its heart and found there complete compatibility with the basic reform belief in an increased participation by the citizen in government. The only serious argument advanced against the proposed reorganization and budget system is that it makes the governor a czar, he wrote. The governor does not hold office by hereditary right. He is elected for a fixed term by universal suffrage. He is controlled in all minor appointments by the civil service law. He cannot spend a dollar of the public money which is not authorized by the legislature of the state. He is subject to removal by impeachment. If he were given the powers here proposed, he would stand out in the limelight of public opinion and scrutiny. Economy in administration, if accomplished, would redound to his credit. Waste and extravagance could be laid at his door. Those who cannot endure the medicine because it is too strong must be content with waste, inefficiency, and bungling, and steadily rising cost of government. The system here proposed is more democratic, not more royal, than that now in existence. Democracy does not merely mean periodic elections. It means a government held accountable to the people between elections. In order that the people may hold their government to account, they must have a government that they can understand. No citizen can hope to understand the present collection of departments, offices, boards, and commissions, or the present methods of appropriating money. A governor with a cabinet of reasonable size, responsible for proposing a program in the annual budget and for administering the program as modified by the legislature, may be brought daily under public scrutiny, be held accountable to the legislature and public opinion, and be turned out of office if he fails to measure up to public requirements. If this is not democracy, then it is difficult to imagine what is. As in Moses' Oxford thesis, the tone of underlying principles was often lecturing and dogmatic. Refusing to debate whether the consolidated state agencies should be under governor or legislature, he wrote, "The Constitution says that the executive power shall be vested in the governor. There is no other way." But, as in the thesis, the tone was also evangelistic. A consolidation of 100 or more offices affects political patronage vitally, he wrote, and it requires considerable courage and intelligence. Nevertheless, state after state was taking steps toward such reorganization. A steadily more informed citizenry, demanding efficiency and economy in government, was pushing them forward, he said. It was time for New York to join the march. In those 5,200 words, and in other sections of the 22,000-word summary of recommendations with which the report began, was distilled the essence of the philosophy of progressivism in general and the Bureau of Municipal Research in particular. It was all there, the bywords which New York's reformers had been chanting for 20 years, executive budget, longer terms, consolidation, responsibility, commensurate power. The incantation, like a drum roll underlying the chant of efficiency and economy. The idealistic belief that citizen knowledge of the intricacies of government and participation in those intricacies was the panacea for democracy. At one point, defending the imposition of an income tax, Moses wrote, "One of the possible benefits, because of people's interest in the spending of their money, will be the development among citizens of a more vital interest in state organizations and expenditures." In specific recommendations, Moses followed the Bureau's creed, except where practical considerations introduced by Mrs. Moskowitz intruded, commandment by commandment. The 187 agencies should be consolidated into departments, 16 instead of 12 because of Mrs. Moskowitz, and each department headed by a single officer, except in certain cases where considerations, Mrs. Moskowitz's, dictated the retention of a council or board. The governor should be given the power to appoint and remove all department heads and key administrative officials, with the exception of the comptroller, whose independence is necessary because his function should be to act as a watchdog on expenditures, including those of the governor. The governor should be given the power to designate certain of his appointees as a cabinet, which would meet regularly to advise him. The governor's term should be extended to 4 years. The long list of elected state officials should be reduced to the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and comptroller. An executive budget system, including not only expenditures, but a plan for raising the revenues necessary to pay for them, should be drawn up by the governor, and only then submitted to the legislature. It should be safeguarded at every step by public hearings to doubly ensure that the financial policy of the state would not be decided upon behind the closed doors of either executive chamber or committee room. The commission's recommendations, which took 44 pages to summarize, were backed up with 375 pages of remarkable detail. The governments of other states, every other state, were analyzed. So were every one of New York State's 187 agencies. Included were descriptions of each agency's powers, tabulations of the laws which had, over the years, given them those powers, analyses of how their powers overlapped those of other agencies, descriptions of the power they would be given under the proposed reorganization plan, lists of the personnel of every existing and every proposed agency, the salaries and duties of the personnel, the organization charts, some of which, folded for inclusion in the bound report, opened out to a full 5 feet in length. Lists were made of the personnel each of the departments should have, down to the precise number of clerks a specific commissioner might need. For internal changes within agencies or departments, and thousands of them were recommended, only new laws, statutory changes, would be required, the report concluded. For 3 of the proposed major governmental changes, creation of the 16 departments with provision that all existing state agencies and any that might be established in the future would be placed in one of them, institution of the executive budget system, and extension of the governor's term to 4 years, the state's constitution would have to be amended, each amendment requiring passage by 2 legislatures elected in different years and approved by the state's voters in a referendum. Moses assumed a proprietary attitude toward the report. Certainly he was the driving force in its preparation, wrote its brilliant introduction himself, and rewrote many other sections. Yet he was not the only person who had contributed to it, and he seemed unwilling to admit that fact. "I wrote the report, no question about it," he insisted in later years. "I wrote or rewrote everything in it." It was the practice at the time to list at the beginning of such reports the names of all individuals and organizations who had worked on them. but most members of Moses' staff found that their names were mentioned nowhere. Unhappy about that, they were even more bitter that the Bureau, which they revered, and on whose principles and 1915 report on the same subject this report was based, was not mentioned even once in the document they regarded as the historical climax of all its work, not even in those sections for which the Bureau had, at Moses' request, done all the work. Moreover, Moses' boast that he rewrote everything in the report was not strictly correct. Comparison of staffers' rough draft recommendations for two departments, the only such rough drafts available today, with the finished versions published in the report, show that they are practically identical. Moses' attitude led to one particularly bitter episode. Parts of the summary of recommendations, the second half of the introduction, were written, at Moses' request, by Charles A. Beard, then director of the Bureau's training school and already a noted historian. In particular, Beard wrote the summary of reorganization advances in other states. Whether Moses did any rewriting at all of Beard's work cannot be determined, but Bureau staffers who saw the historian's original copy feel it was included in the final report substantially as written. They were astounded, therefore, to hear that after Beard had written a magazine article on reorganization advances, Moses had accused the author of an economic interpretation of the Constitution of plagiarism. A bunch of us walked into Beard's office one day, and there he was, just ready to spit, he was so outraged, waving this letter from Moses, recalls one staffer. The letter said that Beard had, in effect, plagiarized from the commission's report. We were astounded. In the academic world, there are few sins as bad as stealing another fellow's work, and that was what Moses was accusing Beard of. And we all knew that Beard had written that section, not Moses. And as we were reading the letter, Beard kept muttering, "Well, what do you think of this? What do you think of this?" He was so angry, he didn't know what else to say. Whether Moses wrote all of it or part, the Reconstruction Commission report was something of which a man could be proud. From the moment, on October 10, 1919, that it was published, it was hailed as a historic document, not only by Smith, who had sponsored it, and not only by the reformers, who saw in it the finest exposition of their philosophy, but more importantly, by the men who Bell Moskowitz had hoped would hail it, the Republican Federal crowd. Charles Evans Hughes, former crusading investigator, governor, secretary of state, justice of the Supreme Court, and Republican nominee for the presidency, now returned to private life as a lawyer and first citizen of New York State, and Congressman Ogden Livingston Mills, a noted authority on taxation and government finance, volunteered to head a city club study of the report, which concluded that it was deserving of unreserved approbation. When a Philadelphia reformer solicited suggestions from Colonel Henry L. Stimson on reorganizing Pennsylvania's archaic governmental structure, Stimson replied with a copy of the report and an attached note that said, "This paper is, I think, the most helpful one that I could put in your hands, to give you an idea of what I believe to be the correct principles of state government." An informal citizens' committee was formed to back efforts to implement the report, and a little money was raised for the fight. Moses was named secretary of the committee and given a small salary that, with Bella's subsidy, enabled him to continue working full-time for reorganization, and in January 1920, when Smith publicly announced that he would push during the upcoming legislative session for adoption of the report's recommendations, he was assigned the job of making the committee an effective force to assist the governor. The first step was to get the names, to enlarge the committee by adding members whose prestige would lend it political clout. With Hughes, Mills, and Stimson already aboard, the job was easy. As the letterhead of the Citizens' Committee on Reorganization in the State Government was continually reprinted so that the names of the latest joiners would be on it, the list above Robert Moses, Secretary, came to include a cross-section of elements of the state who normally would have had nothing to do with a governor who bore the stamp of Tammany. The second step was to get money for the fight, and Moses wrote the members of the Citizens' Committee for help. Their responses were smaller than their names. Stimson would scribble to his secretary on each of Moses' appeals, "Send $25," but numerous enough to enable Moses to move the committee's files out of his apartment and into a small office at 305 Broadway. When the three constitutional amendments were introduced in the legislature on February 9, 1920, Moses wrote again, "The campaign for adoption must now be pushed with the greatest energy. It will be necessary to raise about $2,000. When, in May, legislative committee chairman refused to let the amendments come to the floor for a vote, and Smith announced that he was considering calling a special session to force a decision, Moses wrote, "We need $1,500. This budget," he added, "presumes the minimum of expenditures. To date, the expenses of this committee have been kept down by volunteer assistance and maintenance of an extra office at the home of the secretary without expense to the committee." The plea so moved Stimson that he scribbled, "Send $50. For executive support, Moses, for the first time in his life, did not have to plead. "You just get the facts and come up with the recommendations," Al Smith had told the commission staffers. He would fight for them. And now he fought, stumping the state to remind the voters that the commission's recommendations were supported by the GOP's most prestigious members and should be treated as nonpartisan proposals instead of as bills being pushed on a Republican legislature by a Democratic governor trying to curb its powers. Al Smith on the stump was a political weapon of the highest caliber. "I believe that I enjoy some little reputation for keeping my word," he said in one speech. I will give it to this legislature, that if they will come with me, take this report, do the best that they can with it, I am not going to be the fellow who insists on getting his bill the way it is printed, without compromise in the form it is first introduced, because usually that fellow doesn't want the bill. And I will promise them now that at no time in the future will it ever be referred to by me or anybody over whom I have any control as any program of mine. The fact of the matter is, it is not my program. The real truth about it is I could not think that all out myself." When, at a women's city club debate between Smith and Lieutenant Governor Seymour Lohman, a Republican, Lohman charged that the reorganization program was Governor Smith's attempt to make himself a king, Smith arose and, after alluding, just long enough to bring tears to the women's eyes, to his poverty-stricken youth in an Oliver Street tenement, pointed to himself with a deprecatory gesture and said with plenty of sarcasm and just the right little touch of bitterness, "Behold the king of Oliver Street." To get the maximum use out of the big names on the Citizens Committee, Mrs. Moskowitz wanted them, and their support of Smith's proposals, kept in the public eye. But they were under pressure from furious Republican regulars who told them, correctly, that their financial contributions and prestige were being used to build the career of a Tammany man at the expense of their own party. Many, in fact, were on the verge of resigning. Tact had to be used in handling them. Tact had never been one of Moses' long suits, but now he had been taught by Bell Moskowitz. When he arranged luncheons of the committee and asked its big names to make speeches at the luncheons, speeches that the press would report, he made the requests and pressed for answers persistently but gently. He displayed a willingness to compromise that was also new to him. When some members of the committee, expressing doubts that all the committee's recommendations were correct, threatened to resign, Moses wrote assuring them that "these amendments are not final, but are subject to correction after consultation." There were few resignations, none from significant names, and, month after month, Moses directed an almost daily fusillade of support for Smith's position from Hughes, Stimson, Wickersham, and even, in what amounted to the most impressive coup for Smith, from former state Republican chairman Frederick C. Tanner. Under this onslaught, the legislature reeled. Republican assemblymen and senators assured the public that they were interested in reorganization too, and introduced bills of their own, which they said had the same objectives as the commission's. This put the battle on a technical level, Smith needed rapid analyses of the Republican bills to determine whether their sponsors' claims for them were true. Mrs. Moskowitz summoned Moses to Albany, and, with Mary making sure he had the $5.42 for the fare in his pocket, he left the apartment at 6 a.m. to catch the early train to the Capitol. At first, Moses worked in a small office in the recesses of the Capitol, but as the legislative session moved toward a climax, he was called more and more frequently to the executive chamber. Having him at hand saved everybody time. If the governor and his advisors wanted to know how many jobs a proposed GOP bill would eliminate and whose jobs they were, or whether the wording of a bill conflicted with seemingly contradictory wording in the Constitution, or whether there was any precedent to back up a proposal of their own, or how many secretaries there were in the Public Works Department, or how much was spent annually on printing by the Insurance Department, or under what act the Conservation Commission was empowered to bottle and sell water from Saratoga Springs, it was easier to ask Moses than to try to find out the answers themselves. Because Moses always knew. He thought fast and he answered quickly, says one who observed him at this time. He seemed to know the makeup of every department in the state and what its powers were and exactly which sections of law it got those powers from. And he almost seemed to know it all by heart. Moses' technical expertise gave Smith the ammunition he needed. When Republican legislators introduced bills that appeared to consolidate all public works construction into a single department headed by a public works commissioner, it was Moses who discovered, and enabled Smith to announce to the press, that the bills did not specifically mention any method of appointment for the commissioner, and that, under parallel sections of the state constitution, he would therefore be an elected official rather than one appointed by and responsible to the governor. When Republican legislators introduced bills that created the 16 new departments which the commission had recommended, it was Moses who discovered, so that Smith could announce, that the bills contained no provision that all state agencies be placed in one or another of the departments, and therefore, under existing provisions of the Constitution, all existing agencies would continue to be independent of the departments. A furious Republican senator strode into the executive chamber one day and asked Smith, "Who is this fellow Moses, anyway?" The governor leaned back and laughed. "Why," he said, "he's one of your crowd. He's a Republican." The senator, checking, found that Moses did indeed call himself an independent Republican. By the time the session ended, the legislature had been bludgeoned into passing bills incorporating most of the Reconstruction Commission's statutory changes and the 16-department constitutional amendment, although the amendment would have to be repassed by another legislature. And although the legislature voted down the executive budget and 4-year term proposals, Moses felt confident that the whole program would be passed during Smith's next term. But the next term was not Smith's. With the backing of many of the old-line reformers, independents, and Republicans who normally would have supported his opponent, Nathan L. Miller, the governor ran 1,090,000 votes ahead of his ticket. But the head of the ticket was presidential candidate James M. Cox, and Cox, along with the Democratic vice presidential nominee, young Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was caught up in the Harding landslide and lost New York State by 1,200,000 votes. In an era in which ticket splitting was far more unusual than it would be a half century later, more than 1 million New Yorkers had split their ballot to vote for Al Smith. The phenomenon was considered unprecedented in American politics. Elderly reformer William Church Osborne wired Smith, "Even in defeat, you came closer to swimming up Niagara Falls than any man I have ever seen." But the man the wire was addressed to was, nonetheless, a loser. And, Moses was afraid, so was the Reconstruction Commission program. For a while, dreams had seemed near to realization. Genuine accomplishment had seemed close. Moses had, after all, been the moving force in the drafting of a plan to remake the machinery by which more than 10 million people were governed, and he had watched the bills that embodied a substantial portion of that plan move torturously but steadily along the road to reality. But without at least the 16-department constitutional amendment, the statutory changes were meaningless, and in 1921, Miller opposed the amendment's repassage, and the legislature never let it or the executive budget and four-year term proposals out of committee. The Citizens' Committee on Reorganization in the State Government, with its extra office at the home of the secretary without expense to the committee, was disbanded. To anyone who was, at the time, watching the career of the secretary, these developments must have seemed just another defeat in a life already crammed with defeats. In reality, however, something new had happened, something that would not only ensure that the Reconstruction Commission's proposals would eventually become law, but that would also change the shape of Bob Moses' life. Out of public office in 1921 and 1922, Al Smith was back in New York, working as president of a large trucking company. The company's owners were Irishmen from the old neighborhood, men who were not only the friends of Al Smith's youth, but who, in his maturity, idolized him. Since the company's offices were on Canal Street, only 8 blocks from City Hall, a continual stream of city officials, men who had risen through the Tammany organization with Smith, walked the 8 blocks to drop in on the governor and pass the time of day. Hoping that Smith would accord them the supreme honor, an invitation to walk home with him across the neighborhood to his apartment on Oliver Street, the company's owners and the city officials would often find excuses to hang around his office in the late afternoon. Moses, meanwhile, was working for the new reform organization, the New York State Association, in a shabby cubicle at 305 Broadway, barely large enough for his desk and that of a part-time secretary. He was close to being out of even quasi-official touch with government. Occasionally, he would have lunch with one of the few people he knew in the City Hall area, former Bureau or Reconstruction Commission staffers like Ernie Wilbonsader, who were now lower echelon city employees, but more often he had to eat alone. He had few visitors. But in the late afternoon, the phone would often ring. Moses would pick up the receiver. "Bob," Al Smith would rasp, "how about walking home with me?" The two men made an odd pair as they walked through the winding, narrow streets of the Lower East Side in the twilight, one of them tall, slim, handsome, and aristocratic in bearing, the other short, pot-bellied, florid. The taller man, striding out with the long, swinging steps, continually had to shorten his stride to let the other, who walked with a slow, extremely pigeon-toed gait, catch up. Their progress was further slowed by Smith's popularity. He seemed to know almost every man and woman who passed, and when one of them stopped to chat, he would stop too, and talk with him without appearance of impatience, while his companion would stride restlessly in little circles, or, trying desperately to stand still and listen politely, would nervously clench and unclench his fists. But between the chats with passers-by, there was plenty of time for talking between Moses and Smith, and not all the talking was done by the former governor. In fact, as twilight walk succeeded twilight walk, more and more of it was done by Moses. The ideas on government which he had poured forth for almost a decade, the theories, proposals, plans, advice, the dreams with which he had bored staffers at the Bureau of Municipal Research, examiners at the Municipal Civil Service Commission, borough presidents, park commissioners, and a legion of minor city officials, now were poured forth again. The late afternoon calls from Smith became more frequent, with regularity now, when the two men had arrived at the old red brick tenement in which the former governor lived, he would invite Moses up for dinner. And one day, Bob Moses barged into Ernie Wilbonsader's office. He was striding fast, almost running, more excited than Ernie had ever seen him before. "Ernie," he said, "Al Smith listens to me." Chapter 7. Change in Major. Men who saw in the bond between Robert Moses and Alfred Emanuel Smith a key to the shape in which the future of New York State and New York City unfolded, as well as to one of the great stories of American politics, never told in its full depth, the blood feud between Smith and Franklin D. Roosevelt, would wonder what had forged between the two men of independence and pride and ambition a tie so strong that, transcending independence and pride and ambition, it would be ended only by death. Certainly there was nothing in the backgrounds of the two men to bring them close. Moses' youth was